Welcome to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. Our program this week is an assortment of stories that are going to lead us in some wildly different directions, from Penn Station to the Pratt Library, from the city's Department of Transportation headquarters to off-the-radar back-alley bike routes. Stories about alternative currency, digital graffiti, traffic lights, and musical diaries. Random as they might sound, these stories all carry a common thread, as we're about to hear. That theme? Circulation, movement, cyclical motion, flow. And so, with our theme of circulation as our radio guide this hour, we're going to go ahead and warm up at the gym.
Blood circulation really is an important part of your body's overall function and health.
This is John Kaplan. He's the fitness and wellness director at Baltimore's Meadowmill Athletic Club.
Think of a car and how, you know, clean pistons in the engine help the engine work more efficiently. Our body's the same way. We have so many veins and arteries going through the system which supply the oxygen to the muscles and the organs, and it's just so important.
John is a bona fide fitness evangelist. He runs a nonprofit called Be More Fit, the Baltimore Fitness Academy. He goes into elementary and middle schools and trains teachers on how to get their students' blood circulating with easy little in-the-classroom exercise breaks. And when he's not busy helping kids get into shape, John works here at Meadowmill with a clientele that's, shall we say, in a more advanced age bracket.
All right, we're going to get those joints moving. Cross the arms in front of the chest.
My name is Ann Kimball, and I'm 65.
My name is Jacqueline Slavny. I'm 70 years old. I'm Arch Cheek, and I'm age 72.
I'm Bonnie Norton, and I'll be 78 in October.
And if you can, take it a little deeper. Remember to work at your own level.
This class has been going on for years, since I've been teaching here about 10 years ago, and it's called Senior Sculpt. Its primary audience is seniors. Most of them are retired and have the flexibility to work out at 10:30 in the morning during the week.
Step touch and slowly straighten the body up. Be aware of your core.
Well, I've been exercising for 35 years, and I'm down to twice a week now. But I believe in exercise for mental as well as physical health.
Well, I think it keeps my circulation going, and it keeps me limber and not as stiff as when I sit all day and read.
And we're going to bend and reach. Both arms up. Up, side to side. Reach.
I love this group of people. They are consistent. They're fun. They're doing it because they really feel better afterwards.
We're going to take that squat down on a three. So it's down, two, three, pop up on four. Down.
Well, it's always an effort to come. But I'm always glad I came.
Waking up in the morning is sometimes you don't feel that brilliant, but exercise really gets you going. Makes a big difference, I think.
When you walk in, you're when you walk out, you are also but you are much lighter, you are much looser, and I stand up straighter.
One of the best things you can do is get that blood circulating through the body into the joints, and you feel so much better.
I thought I was cashing in the chips, and I started here in June, and I feel great. I've got a bounce in my step that I haven't had for 3 years.
All right, nice deep breath, inhale.
I have them go to their stations. They typically have an exercise ball, a mat, a set of lightweights, a set of heavyweights, and we really get going with a full body workout.
Little agility test here. I want everyone to grab your ball. Grab your ball with the right hand. Dribble right, dribble.
Sometimes it's rather undignified, the way we roll around on these great exercise balls and things. We're all of a certain age, but we're all willing to really make an effort and not to worry too much about our dignity sometimes.
What's the toughest part of John's class?
For me, it's getting up off the floor and getting down onto the floor. That's the hardest part.
Well, push-ups. I hate push-ups and things of that nature. I like the jumping around and the, you know, the aerobic part is what I like. But some of the other things that our trainer has us do are torture. but I know they're important, and I do my best.
Well, if the repetitions are too much, sometimes I'll stop because I start hurting, so I'll just stop. But that's okay. You listen to your body.
The overall impact of the exercise, like I said, I don't like it. I still don't like it. I never did like it. But the result is fantastic.
Looking good. Looking good.
They really appreciate it the most. I think the younger population is running, going from, you know, home to work and rushing and, you know, texting and doing all this stuff. That the seniors come from a different culture and they truly appreciate the moment. And it is very rewarding to see people change and their bodies change. And they're very appreciative and they let me know. And that keeps me coming back day after day.
Remember, listen to your body. Your body will tell you if something is not right. It's pretty smart that way.
John Kaplan, Fitness and Wellness Director at Baltimore's Meadow Mill Athletic Club. You can find him online at bemorefit.org. We also heard from John's senior sculpt exercise class members, Ann Kimball, Jacqueline Slavny, Marge Cheek, and Bonnie Norton. From WYPR in Baltimore, this is The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. Our program this hour, a collection of stories about circulation, bodies in motion. And so our next segment brings us into the life and mind of a MARC train commuter. Pete Bybee rides the MARC train from Baltimore's Penn Station to D.C.'s Union Station for work. He's made peace with the commute. The train ride takes about an hour each way, and he's been doing it for 4 years. But he loves his home in Baltimore, and he loves his job in D.C. Pete will cringe, though, when you ask him to think about how many hours of his life have ticked away while he's on that train. But one day, a couple of years ago, inspiration struck Pete.
At first, when I was commuting back and forth, I tried to, you know, do my work as I could, and I had my little smartphone. When that was done, I'd, you know, play games on my phone, whatever it was. And then I started bringing my personal computer with me, which is a Macintosh, and I use it to make music at home. And then I realized there is a way that I could take this and work on my possible pieces of music, but it would be a really short time frame because, you know, the train ride is really only 45 minutes to about an hour and 10 minutes. So I was able to use these pieces of software I had and really sort of escape into that. And I really enjoyed doing that because I could focus on what I was experiencing while I was on the train and sort of use that quickly as creative input to the songs I was making.
That creative input blossomed into a full-length CD. Pete Bybee has titled it On the MARC. He composed it entirely on the train, using sounds generated by MIDI interfaces on his laptop computer and ambient noises collected on the commute itself. This is the first track on the CD. It's called Fulton.
That train ride is probably my favorite one. There are two conductors on there. There's the woman who starts the song, and then the young guy at the end. He's actually the, if you ever have the opportunity to ride the MARC, hunt this guy down. He's usually like the, I believe on the 620 train, which is actually the number of the train is 544. But he is just hilarious. Every time he's walking down the aisles, people are so excited to, you know, give a ticket and talk to him and hear him say something funny. And when he does his announcements for each station, he's just hilarious. And there's always people carrying a lot of luggage, and, you know, everyone wants to have the seat next to them available. So the lady in the beginning, she's always harassing people, saying, you know, you got to make room for other people here.
You're exiting at Baltimore. Please don't miss your stop, or you won't get back there for another hour and a half tonight.
Pete Bybee's music project was a way to feel present during a time when he'd often been on autopilot, spacing out, feeling like a worker bee, alienated and helpless inside a steel box. He took his creative ground rules to heart, and they paid off for him in a way he never could have expected.
I wanted to just use my Macintosh and the software that was in it, and I had a set of earbuds that I would use to listen to the music that I was creating. And I set a rule, the main rule, which is I had to compose this music while I was on my commute, so really while I was on the train and possibly at the train station, but that was it. I wouldn't take it home. I wouldn't put it in my studio and listen to it on the big speakers and start playing the keyboard there, or drums, or whatever it may be. I really wanted to focus on it just while I was on the train. And, you know, that really turned out to be sort of something that I became slightly addicted to. I really, you know, I was really looking forward to my commute. It got to the point where some days I would run out of time and I'd actually have my laptop in my hand and people would be looking at me as they're all exiting the train at Union Station, and I'd have it open and they'd be looking at the software saying, "What is that? What is he doing?" But I would, you know, quickly be trying to save it and make sure that my battery didn't die. And it just became something that was really, you know, a passion for me.
Like any train commuter, Pete has had his share of nightmare rides. But once in a while, along comes a day when everything flows just right.
It was the perfect ride. You know, you normally have certain train rides that are much more crowded, or, you know, 6 to 7:30, and I happen to catch like the 8:10. And the announcement, they're usually sometimes overlapping each other. I don't understand who actually chooses to make the announcement, so sometimes they'll be overlapping. But those two individuals, they do a great job announcing it, but it's also sort of in the background. It's sort of soothing. I wanted to give that presentation that my commute was really soothing at that point in time, and they just made it easier and just sort of let you let go.
Pete Bybee accepts that his music is classified as electronica, but he's quick to point out that everything he's composed is his own creation. No samples, no loops, no borrowed beats, just his own fingertips on his own laptop keyboard. Here's how it works.
Let's give you an example real quick. But it also gives you the opportunity to enter in chords, you know, you can... And that's how I would start writing things.
So these songs are essentially diary entries, real-time interpretations of Pete's commute as it's happening. Some of the compositions even include Pete's voice, sort of. In true diary style, Pete typed his thoughts into his laptop. Then he let his text-to-speech software take it from there.
It is 6:47, 97.5 degrees outside. The AC is working for now. The train is crowded, but not overflowing. Everyone has seats, and the tracks are not too hot. We have made it through one of the hotter days without having to step aside to Amtrak or stop due to no power. Tensions are high, but on the side of the fence you want them to be. Only a few more stops to go. AC is blowing, but the heat, beating through the magnifying glass in this metal container we travel, makes you perspire and weary.
I didn't want to... Someone asked me once, are you going to sing on this thing? Or, you know, what kind of album are you doing? Are they going to be songs? Can I sing along with it? And I didn't know how to capture that because I really wanted to capture the moods of my commute. And I realized that I could type in what I was feeling or experiencing and just have my computer read it back. So I started that track when I was sitting at the Gate C, which is probably the big Mark Penn Line gate, and that was actually the one single journey home that night.
And muster up the energy to move towards their second or third part of the journey home. The ponds, streams, and marshes seem to cry out for help. The Beaver Dam at the airport is down to a trickle of water flowing through it. The beavers stay in a shady spot of a small pool to keep cool. Clothes are darkened with sweat and looking defeated.
For better or worse, Pete Bybee and his fellow commuters spend more time in each other's company than they do with their own extended families. The irony, though, is everyone's a stranger. The regulars all recognize each other. They have elaborate daydreams about what their fellow travelers' lives are like, Pete admits as much, but they all respect each other's anonymity. It's just the code.
I still look at the people that I see on a regular basis, and I still think to this day, you know, what's going through their head? How are they processing this commute? It's an amazing thing to experience every day and just to watch people make the most of it. And I still make songs. I probably have 40, 50, 60 pieces inside my laptop. And the next time I'm on the train, I'll still continue to make songs because I have to go to work and I still enjoy it. And it's an opportunity to focus on something I really enjoy doing in my life. And I sort of wanted to pay respect to Mark, you know, the train system, to sort of force me into creating this sort of hour of creative time that I sort of focus on it myself and I get things done.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Boarding now. Boarding now. Okay, letter C and D on track number 4. Mark, leader train number 417. The schedule is 10 and around.
This is the announcer in Penn Station. And when you go in there in the morning, she's usually just there in the morning, but when she makes her announcements, she just enunciates so beautifully. She has such a strong voice. She takes her time. She has her own way of pronouncing some of the stops there, and it's just beautiful. And I realized that I needed to make this into a song because I see that it picks, you know, sort of brightens everyone's day. It's just so warming to your morning to hear her make her announcements. So I decided to pay her some respect and make a song with her announcements.
Mark Train commuter and musician Pete Bybee. His CD is called On the Mark. He's also created a companion book of photographs to go with it. You can see some of the pictures and hear some more of his music online at petebybee.com. That's P-E-A-T-B-I-B-Y.com. You're listening to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. I'm Aaron Henkin. Our program this week, Stories About Circulation. After the break, we're headed to the Enoch Pratt Free Library. And after that, out onto the streets with a bicycle-riding digital graffiti artist. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. If you're just joining us, we're dedicating this week's show to the theme of circulation. So far this hour, we've gotten our blood pumping at a fitness class for senior citizen athletes, and we've ridden the rails with a Mark Train commuter who's turned his idle hours into a source of musical inspiration. Our next stop, 400 Cathedral Street, the hallowed halls of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. An arsenal of liberty, an apothecary for the soul, call it what you will, but the place would be a royal mess without this woman.
Hello, my name is Brandy Deli. I'm the circulation manager at Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore, Maryland.
Now, if you thought Sisyphus had it tough pushing that mythological boulder up the hill, think about this. The Pratt Library System checks in and out around 6,800 items a day. Brandy Deli's circulation department has a staff of 14, plus a crew of 20 reshelvers in a sorting room in the basement. We're going to visit there in a minute, but first, I'm curious about the kind of records you keep of which books go out, how often they go out, and what kind of insights those statistics give you on what people are interested in at various times, depending on the economy or whatever social trends are happening.
Well, one of the biggest trends that we see this fiscal year in FY12 is ebooks. We've circulated around 18,000 ebooks. So that's something that we see is very popular. Typically, what you find on the New York Times bestseller list is what our customers want to check out, such as 50 Shades of Grey. Urban fiction is extremely popular with our customers, as well as your staples like romance and mysteries. With the current state of the economy, we see a lot of people checking out items dealing with resume writing, job hunting. So those are the things that customers are interested in.
So these circulation numbers and statistics, they tell you a lot about yourself as an institution and how you're doing, right? I mean, how important are these statistics when it comes to your own institutional decision-making?
circulation statistics are definitely important. They let us know what our customers are interested in. This helps us decide what kinds of materials we'll buy. With the surge in popularity of ebooks, like I mentioned before, we have to dedicate more of our budget to the purchasing of ebook titles because that's something that our customers want.
Another logical plus with these electronically borrowed titles, no late fees. Whatever this technological quantum leap means for the future of Brandy Deli's circulation department, for the moment, good old-fashioned books and CDs and DVDs still get returned by hand and oftentimes late.
Well, in FY12, we collected around $240,000 in late fees.
You must lose books. I mean, there are probably people who take books out and never bring them back. How many books does a place like this lose every year?
In FY12, we lost around 18,000 items. So that's books, CDs, DVDs, a combination of items.
Is that like average? I mean, is that something you have to accept?
Unfortunately, it is a part of doing business. But in this budget time, it's very important that people return material because our budget has been cut. So what we're able to purchase is not what we could purchase 3 years ago. So it's even more important today that people do return material. And also, I would want your listeners to know that there is a cap with fines. We don't charge more than $6 per item.
So all those people who are out there with that guilty book on their shelf that they suspect might cost them $13,000 to return, that's not the case?
That's definitely not the case. I want to say to them, don't be ashamed. Please bring back the book. You shouldn't have to pay more than $6 for that item. And we do like to work with our customers because we want everyone to have the opportunity to be able to check out material.
In all honesty, have you ever been guilty of returning a book late?
Of course. I try not to, but yes, it happens. I return books late occasionally.
But you don't have any that are sitting on your shelf from 1982?
No, I don't have any books from 1982. And if you have any books from 1982 at home, it'll only cost you $6 if you return it.
My name is David Baldwin. I'm the Stacks and Shelving Supervisor for the Pratt Library, and we're headed to a location called the Sorting Room, which is the nerve center of book sorting and book reshelving in the library.
Down in the basement somewhere?
Yes, beneath street level.
Excellent. Let's head down there.
All right. Down the steps. Below Pratt Street. Everything that's returned to us has to be sorted by subject and reshelved in its proper place, or it can never be found again.
How many books and items do you reckon you sort through on a daily basis?
On a daily basis, I'd say 3,000 to 4,000.
What a fascinating perspective that must give you on the spectrum of literary offerings out there. Are you making like mental catalogs for your own reading list while you're working?
Personally, I've got a stack of about 8 books by the side of my bed, which I'm reading at the present time, and I can't have enough time to read, and that's the thing about us here in the sorting room is actually a lot of young people come in here and they think, oh, well, I'll be able to sit and read and enjoy these books, and I'm afraid the pace that we have to go at to get them back on the shelf, I mean, that's all you can do is make a mental note. You really can't sit down and enjoy a book when you're busy shelving.
When new employees join the Pratt sorting and reshelving team, David Weldon says the learning curve is steeper than at a local branch or a university library, simply because the Pratt main library is so huge. Weldon says without his crew, library circulation would screech to a halt.
The stacks and shelving department down here, we're the anticoagulant because clots in a blood and circulatory system, can cause, fatal maladies, strokes, whatever. And we try to keep everything moving and going back exactly where it should be. So think of us as the anticoagulants, if you will.
David Weldon, Stacks and Shelving Supervisor at the Enoch Pratt Free Library. We also heard from Pratt Circulation Manager Brandy Deli. You're tuned to The Signal on WYPR in Baltimore. I'm Aaron Henkin. Our show this week, a collection of stories about circulation. And so, as we get ready to hear this next piece, let's think about this.
Most of us feel like we know our town pretty well. But in reality, what we actually know is only one well-worn path that we make a habit of traveling every day. In other words, we're all more or less in our own rut. It is possible to pop ourselves out of our ruts, though, with a little inspiration. Signal contributor Matt Purdy recently spent some time with a fellow named Michael Wallace, a.k.a. Wally, and he brings us this story.
Wally had a new idea several years ago. This idea merged bikes and technology and art, and Wally got hooked on it. Now, the thing about new ideas is you've got to name them. So he came up with a few names.
Virtual geoglyphic adventure, digital spray painting. I got all sorts of different names for it. I've been making up names for this since I've started it. It's part of the fun.
And this new idea Wally had, it started with his name. He was messing around on his new smartphone, and he found an app that could track where he went using GPS.
And then I just had this vision, wow, I could probably, you know, track a bike ride. And then from that, it just instantly hit, why don't I try to spell my name on my bike?
So here's Wally's idea. He plans out a bike route that, when you overlay that route onto a map, looks like a line drawing of whatever Wally wants. Pictures, words, symbols, or his name, for example. So if Wally were a painter, his bike would be his paintbrush, and the city streets would be his canvas, and the GPS that tracks his movement forming a solid line behind him, that's his paint. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. For that first ride, Wally wasn't even sure if he could spell his name.
I got going, you know, on the W, and I'm making the A and the LLY, and it was so exciting. When I got to the Y, I finished, and I pulled over, and in this, like, sweaty moment, I checked my phone to see if it worked, and it did, and I was just floored. Oh, my God, this worked. This is amazing. I can do anything.
And that was when Wally got hooked. He found out later that this idea, it wasn't so new. Other people had been doing this for years. But he didn't care. He had carved his name into the streets of Baltimore. It didn't matter that no one else could see it. And now, he wanted to see what else he could make.
Baltimore is happening outside that door right now, and we're going to go out into Baltimore and just, you know, getting a look at what's happening impromptu. There's no, we could see anything today.
Since that first ride, Wally has gotten more ambitious. Shortly after, he made a crab, a rat, then a sailboat, and then his friend's dog, Eastwood. This past summer, he sketched all 7 continents that stretched across the city. I wanted to see for myself what it was like to actually ride along with Wally, so I joined him one morning. He was drawing a tribute to a man who broke every single rule in the Crocodile Handbook.
You're gonna see me break every single rule in the Crocodile Handbook.
That's right, it's the late Steve Irwin, better known as the Crocodile Hunter. He died, of course, 6 years ago after being struck by a stingray. Wally admired his optimism and energy. I admired that he could say things like,
"Almost bit me hand off! Oh, crikey!"
I could never get away with saying something like that. Before we ride, Wally takes me through our route. Looking at the map, Steve Irwin's head is in the Elwood Park neighborhood, and he's feeding a crocodile a slab of meat, and the croc's open jaws cut across the eastern part of Patterson Park. And rippling water stretches from the park to Little Italy. And to make those ripples, we're going to have to dip in and out of many, many blocks.
Yeah, we could count the blocks if you want. You know, it's kind of funny. Notable. Let's do that here. One, 2.
While Wally is counting, I can tell you that the whole route is about 15 miles long. That's like riding from the Inner Harbor to Cockeysville.
37 blocks, Matt. I like to have a little bit more air than usual in my tires for a mountain bike. That helps me when I'm going up hills, when I'm riding around on city streets.
He's wearing his riding uniform, camouflage shorts, t-shirt, dark sunglasses, baseball cap.
I got all the stuff I need in my pockets here. I got the actual tracking device. I've got my fix-it flat in case, you know, we get in a little trouble and pop.
His tires take a beating. One. They've been slashed with glass, nails, and...
I hit a chicken bone this summer. Psst, down went my tire right there on the spot. I'm trying to think, what is this? I couldn't believe I pulled my wheel out, and there it was. Sure enough, there was a chicken bone, like, right in the tire.
Wally shows me our map one more time.
What we're going to do now is we're just going to ride to the corner of Eastern and Elwood. And that's where we're going to start the ride. So this first part, we're just going to get over there.
It's a weekday. We ride through mostly empty streets. People are at work. And the people who are in the street don't pay us any attention. It's all familiar terrain to Wally.
I slowly push further and further away from, you know, right out my front door. And so these are neighborhoods that at one time were uncharted, but now I've been through them many times. So I'm used to the streets here and I know what to expect. I'm going to go left here.
At Eastern and Elwood, Wally turns on the GPS tracking.
And we are live right now. So we're recording live on two different channels. And off we go.
So what we're making right now is the platform that Steve Irwin's going to be standing on to get an idea of like the bigger picture.
The streets are pockmarked with flattened dead rats, and we start keeping count.
Actually invented a classification system for busted rats.
Let's hear it.
Here's number two. I got them everything from a fresh road rat to a CC super peeler, and thick flatties and fuzzy furries, and I got a series of words I made up that kind of keep it lighthearted.
We make slow progress, navigating around construction and catching red lights. We hop curbs and dodge glass. Everything is going pretty well until... That sound you just heard? It's a flat tire.
Matthew, that's the sound of maybe having to start over, because we're gonna find out just how big that is. Now, this isn't my first time I got a flatty. This would be my fourth.
He gets out his fix-a-flat.
I gotta be honest, I'm only one for three of this working. So we're gonna see what happens. Okay, here we go. It's not working. Nope. It's just too
big.
The cut I took on my tire is just too big.
We've drawn most of Steve Irwin, but we didn't make it to the crocodile in the 37 blocks of rippling water.
So we've just completed creating Steve Irwin dropping meat into nothing. Here's a little bit of interesting data here for you. We've gone 3.61 miles together. Now we've been recording for 46 minutes and we've seen 8 dead rats and a lot of busted glass. You got a flat tire that used to be a fat tire. You got a lot of Baltimore going on around you. We've already jumped over some fresh concrete. Well, we've avoided some cars, we've waited at some stop signs, stop lights, and now we're going to sadly walk home and fix this tire and then come back out here and see if we can finish this thing.
It doesn't surprise me that Wally admires the crocodile hunter. He's upbeat and energetic, and he interacts with the world on its terms, not his own.
Just finish this out.
Like Wally.
There's something, you know, there's a sense of freedom when you're riding a bicycle, and you sort of... in contact with everything around you while you're moving. You know, when you're in a car, you don't get the same experience because you're sort of sheltered from the wind and the breeze and elements around. But when you're on a bike, you can feel the breeze hit. You know when you're riding into the wind. The little things become more obvious.
Wally gets excited when he talks about the pictures he's created. But I don't think the pictures are the reason he's made more than 180 of them so far. He doesn't call himself an artist, but like so many artists, I think he enjoys the process of creating more than the product. It forces him out of his ordinary life, out of the comfort of his home, and into the city streets, where he battles broken glass and dead rats, wind and traffic, hills and curbs. It takes him places he never would have gone otherwise. And he comes home sweaty and beat, wondering what he'll make next, and down what street it'll take him.
Signal contributor Matt Purdy brought us that story about the virtual geoglyphic adventures of Michael Wallace, a.k.a. Wally GPX. You can check out some of Wally's images online at wallygpx.com. You're listening to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. I'm Aaron Henkin. After the break, more stories about circulation. We'll meet the people who watch us through the cameras at the city intersections, and we'll talk dollars and cents with the founder of Baltimore's alternative currency, the B-Note. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. Our program so far this hour has been a meditation on the idea of circulation. And somehow, we have managed so far to avoid the topic of traffic. Until now. Next stop, 707 North Calvert Street, Baltimore City Department of Transportation headquarters. Inside this building is a room that looks like a Tom Clancy super spy surveillance center. It's called the TMC. Transportation Management Center. One entire wall of this place is covered by large panel monitors. Each one shows a full-color, high-detail image of an intersection. The place is supervised by this guy.
My name's TJ Bathurst. I'm the TMC manager. And our control room is a 24/7, 365 operation. So we're here constantly monitoring traffic around the city of Baltimore. We have fully staffed personnel here to monitor downtown with our cameras that we have here displayed in our control room. And where we see traffic starting to build, we can notify our appropriate traffic personnel to respond to the area and take a look at it. We can actually change the signal timing from here, so it helps us enable to get a good, up-to-date situational awareness in the city.
My name is Taisha Ingram. I'm in the Traffic Management Center.
So, Taisha, right now, you are sitting in front of the computer that with the push of a button can turn red lights green and green lights red.
Yes and no. It's a little bit more complicated than just that.
Does that feel like an incredible amount of power?
Yes, it's a lot of power, but I mean, I don't want to look at it like that.
Well, you know what they say in the superhero comic books, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes, that is very true. Because you can cause many accidents just as well as preventing them. So, yeah.
A traffic light is a mindless machine, so the poetic saying goes. But not so, according to Paul Manick. There are 1,350 traffic light intersections in this city. It's Paul's job to make sure they're all working. He's Baltimore's superintendent of traffic signal electronics, and he runs this shop across town from the DOT headquarters.
This is a Department of Transportation traffic signal electronics facility.
This workshop is piled with disassembled traffic signals and the big silver control boxes that govern them. You know, the beat-up boxes with the graffiti and the stickers on them at the intersections. Well, inside these containers is an alphabet soup of electronic hardware. Everything from BIUs, bus interface units, to MMUs, malfunction management units.
All of this equipment, the controller, the monitor, the BIU, everything that goes into the cabinet has to be quite robust. It's out there in the most harsh environments. We're talking from extreme cold in our area, thunderstorms, lightning, extreme heat. And there needs to be a commitment to maintenance. If you will, some of your electronics devices, as I can see you're using a recorder right now. Imagine taking your recorder that you take care of every day and keep it in a case. If you put it in a metal box outside, 24/7, 365, that's what we're up against maintaining this equipment.
When Paul and his technicians aren't busy fixing the gear that's broken, they're out there upgrading intersections, one by one. In the past 10 years, they've replaced every incandescent red, yellow, and green light with LEDs. This saves the city money on its electric bill. It also means less maintenance for Paul and his crew down the road.
If you find a traffic light that is out, there's an indication out, maybe there's a green out. We have a reputation being 24/7 of generally, on a typical day, of responding to these kind of complaints in about an hour.
Paul Manick, Baltimore's superintendent of traffic signal electronics. He and his team urge us to drive safely, obey traffic signals, and if a traffic light is out, please treat the intersection as a four-way stop. You're listening to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. I'm Aaron Henkin. John Adams wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson in August of 1787. In it, he said, "All the perplexities, confusions, and distress in America arise not from the defects in their constitution or confederation, not from want of honor or virtue, so much as from the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation." Those words lead us to our next circulation story this hour. It's actually a story about a group of people who've banded together to try to control the flow of money, where it can go and who it can support. It all started with this guy.
I'm Jeff Dickin. I'm one of the founders of Baltimore Green Currency Association. We are a group that started local currency for Baltimore, the B-Note.
B-Notes started filtering into the cash registers of select Baltimore businesses back in 2010. They come in denominations of 1 and 5, and today there are about 28,000 B-Notes in circulation at places like these.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Strati. My husband and I own and operate Avenue Antiques and the Ideal side-by-side antiques shops in Hamden. Right now, there are probably a couple of ones and a five. I always start my bank every day with a couple of B-notes because people do like to get their change in B-notes.
We're at corner BYOB. We're at the corner of the Avenue of Hamden and Elm. We feature a really great talent in the kitchen, which is Chef Bernard DeHanna. 65, 60, 65, 70, 75. About $80 worth of B-notes.
We're here in Tsukasa in Fells Point, neighborhood furniture and home accessories store. We do accept B-notes. I think we have probably $75 right now.
We're here at Zeke's Coffee Cafe on Hartford Road in Northeast Baltimore. And so I'd say we have maybe $100 or so in the registered here.
Hello, I'm Jack. And
I'm Zach.
And we're here at our restaurant, Jack and Zach Food, on 333 North Charles Street. We got about 10 and 1s and about 20 and 5s here.
So it was in the wake of the economic downturn, and I was sitting around with a couple of people, and we were thinking about, well, what can we do to help people have more say in their own economic system and not be taken advantage of by the corporations, by the banks? And it became clear that local currency was one of the best ways to do this, and that it could lead to a lot of other very powerful things down the road.
When you start up a local currency, you've got two groups of people to factor into the equation: the local merchants and the local customers. So who do you start with?
Well, we started with the businesses because they are the anchors of the economic community. We would just go in and we'd say, hey, we're starting a local currency. It's called the B-Note. Some people would look back, they'd be, great, I was waiting for this to happen. Some people really are a little more skeptical, and they need to know that it's backed by dollars that are held in a small local account. They need to know that it helps small business, you know, far greater than using dollars, and even greater than using dollar-based incentive systems like discount cards or incentive programs like that.
There is, in fact, an incentive built into the B-Note system. With 10 U.S. dollars, you can buy 11 B-Notes. This translates to a 10% discount for anyone paying with the alternative currency.
But then beyond that, once they understand that local currency circulates to all of the other local businesses that are accepting it, instead of suddenly going to Walmart and going out to another state or going onto their corporate balance sheet, it does stay here in Baltimore.
When the B-Note program started up in 2010, there was buy-in from 55 local businesses. Today, Jeff Dickin says there are close to 200 businesses on board, most of them in and around the Hamden neighborhood, but also in Fells Point, Hamilton, Lauraville, Mount Washington, and Remington. Several of these businesses operate as B-Note cambios, where you can trade dollars for B-Notes. Dickin promotes, disseminates B-Note business directories, staffs B-Note tables at community events. But at a certain point, he has to step back and simply let the economy operate as it will.
So people start to think about money, what it is, what it does, who it supports. And these are very important questions. People realize that it's just a temporary store of value that they can carry around. And we want the B-Note to be a temporary store of value that encourages people to support their local businesses.
Like any economy, the B-Note is really just an experiment in mutual trust. And it seems to be taking root at places like these.
We're at Karma's Cafe. We're a small little restaurant and coffee shop in Charles Village. I'm Karma. We make almost everything from scratch in-house. We get our bread from a local baker. We get our eggs from a local farm. So as far as B notes go, it's just an extension of how we want to participate in the local economy. 30, 35, 40, 45 $5 bills. The fives have a wonderful ink drawing of Edgar Allan Poe on one side and a raven on the back side. And we're down to $1 in ones.
Hi, we're at Sprout, an organic salon. My name is Alan Kolb. I'm the owner and general manager. And we do take B notes at Sprout. Let me see how many I have in the register. I've got $20 in B notes right now. Every time we get them, I take them and go eat somewhere in the neighborhood. There's half a dozen restaurants right here that take B notes.
So you've got your convincing of local merchants, your convincing of local consumers, and then do you also have to convince the federal government to allow you to do this? I mean, just how much red tape do you have to go through? Can anyone just go out and just start agreeing to trade in alternate currencies?
Yeah, actually, anybody can start a local currency at any time. There's no law against starting your own paper currency because it's really, at its core, just a belief system. It's illegal to mint coins in this country, but it's not illegal to have a paper currency, which is great.
As you might guess, Jeff Dickin of the Baltimore Green Currency Association is no fan of universal mega currencies. He's been watching the rise and fall of the euro very closely and critically.
Because it does point out the pitfalls of this very global or federated system where you put all your eggs in one basket. And it does point out that we've gone too far in that direction toward corporatization, toward globalization, and that we really do need to balance that with a focus on supporting local business and supporting our own communities and the people who live there who are making a living and living right down the street from us.
Do you have your wallet on you right now? How many B notes have you got in your wallet?
Let's see how many B notes I have right now. 28 B notes and only three federal dollars. That really says something, doesn't it?
Jeff Dickin, putting his money where his mouth is. He's one of the founders of the Baltimore Green Currency Association. You can find out all about the B note at baltimoregreencurrency.org. And that's going to do it for this week's program. As we get ready to wrap up, I want to let you know you can always reach us through our website, wypr.org. That's where you'll find on-demand audio and podcasts of the program. We're on Facebook also, and you can check us out there at Signal Radio Baltimore. The Signal is an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. Our theme music comes to us from Wendell Patrick. And special thanks go out this week to Matt Purdy and Shung Puri. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening.